Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the LCI Green Room. This is our live show here at the Libertarian Christian Institute. I'm Jacob Winograd, host of the Biblical Anarchy podcast, part of our Christians for Liberty network, which, by the way, if you want to find out more about, you can go to christiansforliberty.net down there at the bottom ticker, and you'll find all of our shows, including the one that our guest is now a part of, the main flagship show, the Libertarian Christians podcast. Our guest tonight is Cody Cook, who is not new to LCI, but he is in somewhat of a new role as he is now taking on sort of shared responsibilities with the Libertarian Christians podcast. And so him and I thought it'd be a good idea to just do a green room and get to know him a little better. And also, instead of just sending each other 100 messages a day, we can just talk to each other a little bit on a live show instead. So, Cody, how you doing tonight, brother?
Doing pretty well, man. How about yourself?
I'm good. Busy, but I'm excited. You know, we met our fundraising goals for LCI, and we just had our first yearly meeting last night. And I'm excited about everything we got coming up this year. So a lot of growth, a lot of cool things that we got going on. So again, you're not new to LCI. I feel like people have seen you, but I thought it'd be a good idea just to have you on, and we'll kind of start out by just giving you a chance, just for those who maybe aren't familiar with you yet, to give you a little bit of a background on yourself, on the things that you have been doing and are going to be doing now here in the sort of like new role that you're filling. I don't know if you want to start, and I actually don't think I've ever heard you talk about this. Maybe you want to start a little bit about just like what your journey to libertarianism was. And, you know, we can all, it's kind of like, you know, we always do that. Libertarian podcasting is almost like when you're having that sort of like, it's like, for like an AA meeting where you have to show up and kind of give your recovering story. So like, when did you realize you were a statist and then get on the path to recovery?
Yeah. My libertarian testimony, as it were. I guess for me, I think I was always kind of flirting with libertarianism. I at least from kind of preteen on, was very kind of suspicious of you know, the establishment. But what that sort of looked like as a teenager who didn't really have any strong principles was I would kind of bounce back and forth between like sort of a socialism type thing and like kind of libertarianish. My first kind of claim to fame was, I think at 17 years old, I made a really badly done conspiracy theory documentary that appeared on Alex Jones's website. But at that point I wasn't really a libertarian, but of course I was really interested in sort of some of the ideas, but it was really, like I said, more of a vague kind of anti-statism type thing, or anti-authoritarian type thing. So over time, I think, you know, you spend a little time having some conversations, and you know, names come up, and labels and terms come up, and you start to think, okay, so what is this, and how is it different from that? And I think my kind of soft sort of socialist side of kind of, you know, pro-welfare type stuff was one of the last things to sort of go. Not that I'm you know, against, you know, being soft or sharing or anything like that, but the idea that the state had to be involved in it, that there are other ways to do it that work better. So it was kind of, like I said, a slow process, but I was always, I suppose, kind of on the way here.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like by the time I really dived into libertarianism, I realized that even though I had spent a lot of time on the left, that really the things that I thought made me more of a lefty, where, and I, cause like I was always sort of, a zebra among horses on the left. Like I thought I was like, well, I'm not a neocon and I don't like the Republican Party, so I guess I have to be a Democrat. And I was always more attracted to the, you know, I guess like more dissidents, not the right word, but not mainstream left. Right. So that's why I was really into Bernie Sanders. Didn't agree with everything, of his platform, but like, he was like the first, as an adult, the first candidate that I was like really excited about, like sharing posts about, going and attending rallies, trying to like convince my friends and family to switch their voting voter registration so that they could help support him. And but yeah, I think I'm trying to remember if welfare, I think by the time I became a libertarian, I was convinced that there were better answers outside of the state to welfare. I was more concerned. Actually, I did do the whole typical Maraud's thing when I was first confronted with anarchy. So that was fun. So I didn't know that about you, though. You had a, what was it that was, you said it was a little video you made that was shared by Alex Jones?
It was a close to feature length documentary I made. I used a lot of clips from him and other stuff too. And so it was, I don't want to out myself too much and have people start Googling things and finding stuff, but yeah, so that I, in kind of high school, I liked making movies and they were all sort of kind of generally dissident type stuff. And it was like, it was just like all kinds of stuff, like whatever sort of came across my feed, whatever online. So it might be like an anti-vax video or it might be like, you know, whatever. I'm just, and I just kind of went all over the place, kind of bouncing back and forth between, but one of the things I like,
I forget, how old are you?
I'm, 37 now. So it's been a while. Okay. Yeah. It's been about 20 years. It doesn't seem that long, but you know, the Bush years, I had a friend, we would figure out where like the police drug checkpoints were and we'd like show up and like read him the Fourth Amendment. And so it was, that was the kind of stuff I like to do. But like, once again, it was really not cohesive. I didn't have like a cohesive political worldview at the time. I just didn't like, you know, the establishment or anything that sort of smacked of too much authoritarianism to me.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Yeah, so you're about my sister's age, and yeah, it feels like, I guess, like sort of the mid to late millennials, you know, especially like those of us who I guess were kids during the 90s. Like, I think a lot of us have a little bit of a dissident sort of a rebellious streak, which I guess I don't know. I don't even know what to make of the Zimmer generation, to be honest, because they kind of just don't seem to all be one thing at all. But anyway, what's your so I know you're, have you always been, oh, you're Anabaptist, have you always been Anabaptist? Were you raised in that kind of church environment, or what's your story there?
No, the mom's side of my mom's side of my family, there were some Methodist circuit riders way back when, but basically by the time I came around, it was very what's the word I'm looking for, kind of nominal Christian. Okay. That side of the family was Southern Baptist, so the kind of the opposite direction. And so because
Have a Calvinist like great grandfather or something?
Not that I know of, but it's possible. Yeah.
Return to tradition at some point.
So I was saved in the Southern Baptist church as a kid. And so, you know, naturally I was an atheist by the time I was 11. You know, my kind of journey back was sort of a slow kind of moving thing, but I think my personality type is I'm a bit sort of obsessive compulsive, not, you know, diagnosed or anything, but like in the sort of, you know, popular sense of the term. So like when I came back around to Christianity and was persuaded of it, I, you know, really wanted to dig in. And so like, I, you know, went into Bible college. I didn't necessarily know what I was there to be. I assumed maybe I was going to be a pastor, cause that's what everybody else was there to do. But I just really wanted to like dig in and understand it better. And then, you know, you start spending a little bit of time digging through church history and you go like, these Anabaptists are kind of really interesting. Like they're, you know, they really stuck out in a lot of ways from, you know, the Reformation, kind of the Magisterial Reformation, Luther and Calvin and Zwingli. They like actually believed in like a voluntary faith and believed in separation of church and state. They were pacifists, which I wasn't exactly sure if I agreed with, but it sounded kind of interesting. So yeah, I think, you know, but I've always been, as I've been sort of a Christian, I've always been one of those sort of who wanted to just call myself a Christian and not really use a lot of labels. But I've always sort of, if people were to ask me like what I, you know, kind of where I was, I'd say, well, I really like what a lot of the Anabaptists have to say. And when I got saved, I went to a friend's, I had a friend who was Seventh-day Adventist who kind of helped me on the way. So I started going to a Seventh-day Adventist church, which meant on Sundays I could go anywhere I wanted. So I would travel around and go to different churches sometimes, and there were like Mennonite churches I check out, but they were, none of them were very close, but you know, I'd had nothing else to do. I was like 20 years old. So, so I would go check that stuff out. So anyway, in the last few years, I think I've been more comfortable with embracing the label, Anabaptist, while acknowledging that, you know, not everything they've always said is good or correct or whatever, but that's broadly, I feel pretty comfortable with that label.
Yeah. I've talked to you about this in our private exchanges. Anabaptist is like, now, like, I know a little bit of the history, of course, but I've never like studied Anabaptist thinkers or theologians with much, like, just I haven't invested a lot of time into that. Mm-hmm. And I've never really attended at least like an explicit Anabaptist church. I don't even know, like, I know very little about how they organize, like, what mm-hmm. sort of like do they have any sort of like you know, so like, you know, Lutherans and Presbyterians are denominations that have sort of like they have liturgy, they have like authority structures and whatnot for like internal discipline and whatnot. Like, is mm-hmm. the Anabaptist church just more of a, like, is there a like Anabaptist church, or is it just more like a theology, and there's churches that embrace it to varying degrees?
It's kind of a theological stream, like Reformed, you might say, is, you know, so like different groups within Anabaptism would be like Mennonites, who range from sort of traditional conservative plain dress to, you know, just sort of, you know, hippies who vote for, you know, Harris or whatever. Amish are part of that stream as well. Hutterites, who, there used to be a lot of Hutterites in the United States, but they left during World War I because they were conscientious objectors, and a lot of them went to Canada. But Hutterites are really interesting because they practice voluntary communal property. So they all sort of live together in the same land. They have like their own houses and stuff, but there's really like an emphasis on working together. It's sort of organized in such a way that people sort of have different jobs they're supposed to do, and it's all sort of for the good of the broader community. Which is, you know, in the West, kind of a free market attitude. I think we tend to be suspicious of communism, but the one benefit of kind of the way they do it, first of all, it's voluntary. But second of all, you know, when you get older and you're not able to work anymore, you're still a member of the community, so you're taken care of. And so I think one thing that really sticks out with Anabaptists, they tend to be very community oriented. And I think, you know, largely in the 16th century, they didn't make this distinction that the Protestants made between the visible church and the invisible church. And the reason they didn't make that distinction was because when early Protestants said that, what they meant is there's the state church, which is everybody has to pretend to be Lutheran or whatever. And then there's the people who are actually saved. And so the Anabaptists said, but we don't have time for that nonsense. Are you here or are you not? Are you saved or are you not? If you're not saved, then we don't want you. If you're not serious, then we don't want you. Go somewhere else. And so the idea was, you know, and you know, that their belief in adult baptism only, or believers baptism only, was they rejected, I think, really the political rationale for infant baptism. There are, of course, theological rationales for it as well. But the political rationale for infant baptism was that you are baptized not only into the church, but into the state church. And so the only people who were not baptized were Jews, and they weren't really citizens. You know, for Anabaptists, they sort of said, well, that's not a real baptism. Baptism is something you do when you make a choice to follow Jesus. So everything they did was very just kind of on the surface. You join the community, you're part of the community. They tended to practice church discipline because they sort of felt like that was, you know, of course, non-violent, non-physical church discipline, because it's like, well, the world uses violence to discipline. We don't do that. We use persuasion and so on and so forth. But if you don't really want to be a part of the community, then you are, or you're not, you know, you're committing adultery or whatever. You're sort of pushed out sort of into the world in a way, or at least that's sort of the danger, the threat. So yes, there's some of those things like church structure and all that. I don't want to talk too long about this. I'm trying to answer your question, but also not bore everybody, but maybe I've given enough of an answer at this point.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, I live here in, South Central PA, so I'm familiar with like the Amish and the Mennonites, but like, they don't have like churches down the street from me that I can go and just easily visit. They're not like, a lot of the churches like in our area are very like ecumenical, like we do stuff together, and like you just don't see Amish and Mennonite like doing that. So like I've met plenty of the people, but just never really had a chance to, like, other than what's sort of already commonly known about them, like, you don't get much chance for, or like, unless I were to intentionally seek it out, which I just haven't, because I have a very, I've been part of the same church since I was 16 and very happy there. So just, anyway, but you know,
So most of what you've learned has been from romantic Amish fiction, right?
What's that?
Most of what you've learned has just been from romantic Amish fiction books.
Right, yeah, and from the what was that show? The Amish mafia. No, I mean, I think it's such a different world to me, right? So I was raised Pentecostal, like charismatic, sort of like non-denominational churches. They were sort of like the churches that I were part of were related to Assembly of God, but not directly associated. But they were like an offshoot, like people who used to be Assembly of God churches and then kind of started their own thing. And it was a little woohoo at times growing up. And then the church I ended up now is kind of non-denominational, but they have a very strong Reformed, you know, more Calvinistic leaning. But everything in my church experience is just very different than, I guess, sort of like, I have a lot of exposure, but just not much with anything resembling, you know, like actual, like, I guess, like explicit, like Anabaptist believing Christians, other than private dealings with them. I wonder, I mean, like, you obviously are very passionate about this. You have a book you've written about this that LCI is publishing. I just, again, it's hard for me to like step outside my worldview because I have such a bias towards thinking that Christians need to be very like steeped in the culture and actively trying to shape it and transform it. And it's just like, I wonder, do you think that that's maybe something that Anabaptists need to maybe slightly evolve on, even if maybe like they're right that they should have some separation? But it's like, I don't know, like if the church has a missional call, I just like, maybe I'm missing something, right? I'm genuinely curious, but like what do these different Anabaptist groups do to kind of like outwardly grow the, I guess they don't use the distinctions of visible, invisible, but to just grow the church, right? And to try to like, again, I have a Reformed, but like we're Reformed Christians, we obviously are right about everything. And so we need to go and tell everyone how right we are about everything. So
yeah,
to see a group of Christians who don't act that way is like, it's like the first fish that grew legs and came out of the ocean. You know, that's what it looks like to me.
Yeah. I mean, the Reformed have a much more sort of integrated approach to church and culture. And I mean, and honestly, church and state too, outside of the libertarian world. And so it's not always necessarily clear where one ends and the other begins. I think the Anabaptists have a tendency to maybe go the other direction, which is to really want to emphasize separation because they see the world as one thing and the church as another thing. And I, you know, I certainly know people who say things like, don't send your kids to public, don't send your Christian kids to public school because you hope they're going to evangelize the other kids or whatever. Like, you know, you need to be like concerned about maintaining, so like, I think there's that separation is spent as well than in other, communities and other denominations where there's this, but I think trying to figure out that balance, between how do you be separate from the world? How do you figure out a way to sort of be in it, but not of it, but also be in it. Right. And so I think, when you look at the earliest Anabaptists, I've got another book coming out this year too, in addition to the one LCI is publishing. So the LCI is publishing the Anarchist Anabaptist, and I'm also publishing one called the Pocket Anabaptist with a Wiffenstock, that's like a concise Anabaptist systematic theology. And so I've spent a lot of time looking at the very earliest Anabaptists, and you could argue that they were actually much more evangelistic than the Protestants, the Magisterial Reformation folks were. And part of the reason why is because the Protestants were basically just like, okay, France is Catholic and Germany's going to be Lutheran and Switzerland's going to be Reformed, right? And so they sort of almost like sort of cut it up, and it was something that has sort of happened through the state. Whereas Anabaptists, basically, they would have these, you know, the churches would sort of have these meetings where they'd sort of, pray over these people that they would send off essentially to go preach the gospel and die because Protestants and Catholics were going to kill them. The early Anabaptists had a much stronger emphasis on evangelism than you're certainly going to see from the Hutterites and the Amish. They have this sort of city on a hill thing, right? Well, if I'm the city on the hill, I better not leave the city, And so the hope or the expectation is that people will see, how family oriented they are and how they maintain their faith and how they have all these wonderful traditions. And people on the outside are going to say, how do I get in on that? But what really happens is people go, that's weird. What are they doing? And so it's not really the evangelistic approach that they hope it's going to be. So I do think that is actually a danger in taking on a very strong separationist kind of approach. So the kind of Anabaptist that I am is, I'm pretty aware of pop culture, and I'm happy to do things and talk to people of different perspectives. I'm not sort of cloistered away in some community in Pennsylvania. But I do appreciate what is behind that concern, that they want to be separate from the world, that they want to be a community that's faithful and takes care of each other. When Paul talks about disciplining people by sending them out to Satan, I mean, that's really, I think, kind of what they were seeing, right? You know, what Paul was doing is he's casting these people outside of the church. And so they're now in Satan's territory. And so I think that's not the idea behind what they're getting at, I think, is a good one, but it has to be tempered and balanced with other concerns that I think are equally important.
No, I think that's fair. I would agree with that. I mean, it's like, it's not even like my hope. So although I'm very opinionated, I'm also very ecumenical. And I kind of feel like I would want Anabaptists to venture out more and be a bit more evangelistic than they seem to be today. I mean, what you're doing, like, you could almost call it like a punk urban Anabaptist approach, right? in a little way, which I think, I mean, is the same thing. Like, I know there's a lot of, even in libertarian land, right, people in libertarian circles can sometimes be like, yeah, what we need to do is just all move out to the country and just have our farms and live off the land. And I remember, like, a couple of years ago, there was this trend going around of, like, urban agorism, where it was like, no, actually, we can be libertarians, we can be countercultural, we can even, like, build counter economics and kind of live outside the state, even in very urban areas where it seems counterintuitive to pursue something like that. And so it's like, yeah, I guess, like, the whole, like, metaphor of, like, city on a hill makes kind of sense. But, like, if it's a city on a hill out in, like, an isolated region no one sees, maybe it's not as useful as, like, go build your city on the hill within a city, right? And make it more like a bright neon sign that people are going to notice. It just occurs to me that that'd be interesting, right? Like, I think, because, like, in terms of, we once, as a church, went on a men's retreat to a retreat center that was basically run by a bunch of Mennonites. And I mean, super friendly people, super attentive to our needs. Like, it's like, there's a lot there that, like, they do a good job, I think, of embodying a lot of, like, Christian values, Christian lifestyles. It'd be nice to see them live that out in a way that's a bit more, I guess, like, public.
In the Anarchist Anabaptist book that LCI is going to be releasing in February next month, I kind of explore a little bit, because what I essentially argue is that the Anabaptists preceded libertarian thought, that they were, in a way, the first libertarian Christians, if we don't count the early church. I explore a little bit, like, you know, what kind of anarchists are Anabaptists. And I think, you know, obviously there's some overlap with agorism, that they sort of create these separate communities that are sort of tangentially related to the world and the economy of the country where they live, but it's also not, it's separate. Also, I think voluntarism, there's a lot of overlap there. Not so much overlap maybe with anarcho-capitalism, but I think that there could be some ways to make those connections. But I think the other thing is, Christian anarchism really has two streams. One stream that's activistic, that's trying to kind of make the world look more anarchist, right? And then the second stream, I think, is more separatist, which sort of says, we have an opinion about maybe the way that the world should be and the way the government should run, but ultimately, we're just going to say Christ is king, and we're going to live our lives. And, we're not really going to, we're going to try to live peacefully, coexist peacefully alongside Caesar, but we just don't see him as important or worth our worship, right? And I think Anabaptists have tended more toward that separationist approach than to an activist one. Although I could pull some pretty interesting quotes from Benno Simons and Peter Riedemann and some of these other early Anabaptists who had some pretty strong things to say about, you know, corrupt rulers and those who sort of build their wealth on, you know, invading their neighbors, war profiteering and stuff like that. So there's a lot of interesting overlap, I think, with the way that libertarians approach things and the way the early Anabaptists did.
Yeah, and I guess, like I said, libertarians have the same debates too, which there's always a lot of corollaries between libertarianism and Christianity, this being one of them, this sort of, which I think it's one of the things you and I have been talking about a lot off air, and that I've even talked a lot about in my podcast and in some other green room interviews I've done with people. And even actually, I meant to address this comment sooner. Someone asked if this was Cody from the presidential election stream. Yeah, you were on that stream. I was as well. And kind of was about to say, it was like, even like the whole election cycle at the end of last year and sort of, you know, my involvement in it was very much like, hey, I think there's a, like, we're, my concern was that libertarians and Christians were tilted too much towards the separatist part. And that's not to say that I don't understand the valid concerns, right? I mean, because I do draw lines. Like, I homeschool my kids. I'm very passionate about that. You know, I think if you, the expression I like is like, if you give your kids to Rome, if you give your kids to Caesar, stop being surprised when they grow up to be Romans, right? Like, I mean, if you, like, when people, like, I always tell people, do the math. If you put your kids in public school, and consider how much time they're being around their peers, but also their teachers, and everything else that comes with public school, and then how much time they're around you, and realize that really the lion's share of the raising of your children is being done by effectively the state and people who work for the state by extension. Even if they're good people in public schools, like, listen, like Alex Bernardo, fellow podcast host, he's a public school teacher. I tip my hat off to him for trying to, like, that, even that, like, listen, like, that, I have my lines. I don't judge Alex personally. I'm not going to go as far as to say what he's doing is a waste of time, but I'm more skeptical that that's going to work out than other things, right? Like, there's some, so when it comes to like schooling, I'm very separatist. Like, I don't even think, there are some things where I think, yeah, infiltrate it and make it better. Schooling is like, no, homeschool your kids, you know, I mean, do what you can, if it's school vouchers, if it's other things, but like, make public schools irrelevant. I don't think it's an institution worth trying to make better or reform or anything like that, right? But there are other things that I am more optimistic, like, I think we can make a difference in, but, and that's both, again, culturally and politically and institutionally. I suppose, I don't know if this is just the only basis of this question is curiosity, right? I think Anabaptists tend to be more amillennial. Is that correct?
So that is a very difficult question to answer.
Okay.
and it's because amongst early Anabaptists, you had kind of a premillennial apocalyptic fervor in some quarters.
Yeah, no, I mean, you were sharing some of that with me the other day.
There was the Munster Rebellion, where a number of Anabaptists, including a guy named Bernard Rothman, I think his first name was Bernard, unless I'm confusing him with someone else. Anyway, Rothman, he took over the city of Munster. He said, this is going to be the new Jerusalem. And so they said, you know, yes, of course, we should be pacifist as an interim ethic, but now that the kingdom of God has come to Munster, now we need to start, you know, using force and you know, making the kingdom come, right? It sounds kind of post-mill, but also pre-mill, right? Other Anabaptists learned very, I mean, who most Anabaptists already thought that guy was nuts, but after that kind of predictably failed, you know, horribly and spectacularly and violently, they said, well, that's why, you know, we really need to sort of not emphasize eschatology so much. And so you'd have guys like Menno Simons who said, yeah, the Lord's coming soon, but I'm not setting any dates. we're just going to kind of wait and see what happens. What sort of happens in the early, you know, 20th century is as evangelicals, you're going kind of dispensationalist. You had a lot of Mennonites who sort of went that direction as well, kind of imbibing it from the culture. But I've kind of done my best to try to suss out kind of who in the early Anabaptist movement were pre-mill, post-mill, on-mill. And it's really not easy to do. And it also depends on kind of how you define these things, because I found Anabaptist theologians who kind of define whether someone's post-mill based on how optimistic they are or how much role they think the church has to play. And it, and so, you know, somebody who may not necessarily be on paper post-mill might be sort of described as post-mill. And so I think I see your mouth moving. You may be saying something.
Yeah, I'm muted by accident. That's even a problem in the Reformed world where there's people who say they're all-mill, but then like there's almost like there's eschatology in terms of what you believe on paper. And then there's like your eschatology in terms of like the praxis of what you right. sort of act upon. And there are some people who are like functionally post-mill, even if maybe they are expressly all-mill. And then yeah. on the flip side, there's even some people who I think go the opposite way where they say they're all-mill, but then they're functionally pre-mill. Right. So it's like, I don't know. It's like, so I've gone full circle on this because I actually, I didn't like the very like left behind dispensational ethos I was brought up in. And I kind of, as a young adult, said, eschatology doesn't matter. I don't care about the end times. I don't know when Jesus is coming back. Doesn't affect how I live today. I'm just going to focus on living for Jesus today. And whatever happens in the end times is whatever happens in the end times. Part of me still kind of agrees with sort of the heart of that. But I guess I just realized that people like, if everyone could agree to that, I'd be fine with it, right? The problem is there's so many people who don't agree to that. And so then they go into other things that I've realized, like, okay, people's eschatology has a great impact on a lot of other things that they believe and then act out, right? And so, like, sometimes I feel like in the all-mill and pre-mill camps, because like they're pre-mill, then there's like all-mill who are functionally pre-mill. Because there's yeah. somebody who just kind of say, well, we're all just kind of like, all we're trying to do is make more believers until Jesus comes back. And other than that, like, you know, we can like maybe making more believers might make the world a little bit better of a place, but like that's not really our focus. And so that I think leads into that sort of separatist tendency a little bit, which is why I was, I mean, I'd be curious if there could be, other than the example you gave, a post-mill in a Baptist theology. That would seem to be kind of counterintuitive, but.
Well, it depends, because, yeah, not all post-mills are necessarily politically oriented, right? They're not necessarily all theonomists. There has been within, kind of a, that tradition of piety, sort of a pietistic post-millennialism that wasn't so concerned about kind of building the state as it was, the church kind of having victory through evangelism and through changing the culture, right? The things that I think do stand out, though, in Anabaptist eschatology, especially in the early years, the two things that I notice is their thoughts on violence, for example, that it really kind of leads into like the Book of Revelation, where the church are always or maybe are often martyrs, but they're never oppressors. And I think the other part of that is it kind of dovetails into the other aspect, which is they have a real now but not yet eschatology. And so when you look at the way like Luther dealt with the Sermon on the Mount, Luther was a little better on this than he's sometimes accused of being, but we'll say the way maybe a lot of dispensationalists look at the Sermon on the Mount. They'll say, this is an ethic of maybe what the millennium will look like. And it's supposed to call us, it's supposed to show us how sinful we are because we can't live up to it. And the Anabaptist said, no, Jesus told us to live up to it. So I think we ought to try. And so for them, this ethic that seems so future oriented, that's the kind of the way that you would live if you actually believed that God was sovereign and was going to take care of things. And you could sort of just do the right thing all the time and not worry about the consequences. That's really the way that this kind of now, but not yet thing, where because Jesus came, you know, the future and the present are kind of overlapping. So heaven and earth have kind of met, and we're in that sort of middle area in that Venn diagram. So in particular, they do the same thing with the Isaiah passage about swords into plowshares that the early church did. They said, this has been fulfilled. You know why it's been fulfilled? Because Christians, from all over the world and from all countries all over the world come together, and we lay down our swords and we lay down our weapons, and we're peaceful and we're loving and we love our enemies and our neighbors, and that's been fulfilled. So maybe that leads into the, because I mentioned that I think during our debate. So if you want to discuss that at some point, we could jump into that. But
no, they
really felt like that had been fulfilled.
Yeah, no, that will tie into it. And the already not yet aspect of the kingdom of God, I think that is best. I think most people of any eschatology would want to affirm that aspect, but I think amillennialism properly understood best encapsulates it. And I've come to the point of an amill where I'm like, I'm an optimistic amill when it comes to, like, I don't think I'm amill in a sense where I don't think things are guaranteed to get better, but I think we can make things better. I mean, even if it's just temporary or localized for a time, like that can just be part that can still be important, right? That can be part of the witness of the gospel into other people's lives. But at the end of the day, it's like, what I used to believe, even where I said it didn't matter too much. It's like, I don't know if I tend to think there's not a literal 1,000 years, but is there going to be something like are we living in the reign of Christ now? Yes. After Jesus comes back, will he reign physically on earth for a certain period of time? I don't really see a strong reason to believe that, which is why I'm not post-mill, but it's also like, I mean, if it happens, it happens. It doesn't really matter what I don't have to believe that for that to happen anyway. So, that's why I've been attracted to amill the more I looked into it. And I think it makes most sense with what scripture reveals, because I think it allows you to, if you have a properly understood amillennial perspective, I think that allows you to not fall too much into, like, not that you, I guess you still can, but I think it gives you the best chance of not falling too much into either camp of either being too separatist or too, like, you're such a transformationalist that you're like, and we're going to make it happen by, merging with the state or using state power or something like that. You brought up those passages there, which came up in our pacifist debate.
I was going to say that the post-mill people say that sometimes they have an optimistic eschatology. But I don't know about you, but Doug Wilson running the country doesn't make me feel very optimistic.
No, I mean, I've done so much eschatology the past year, and although it's like I get really into it now, but I've also realized somewhat that for some people, it's just like, there's people who care about eschatology, and then there's people who really don't care about eschatology, and there's really not a middle group there. So it's like that kind of conversation, like, only interests some Christians, in my experience at least. But I think it's important. I think it impacts a lot of things, including, like, some of the passages you brought up, which are somewhat eschatological, also came up in our debate about pacifism, which we did several months ago. Which, if I know people recognize you from the election stream, but hopefully if they haven't seen that debate, they can go back and watch that as well. That's up on, I think, both channel, my channel and the LCI channel. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty fun debate. We did it. I like the way we did it, where I don't think people knew this ahead of time, but we exchanged opening statements so that we could, like, read each other's opening statements and kind of have part of our rebuttals already formed and put together. That was pretty interesting.
I think it makes for a more substantive debate, because instead of me going, oh, I'll have to think about that for a while, I've already had a little bit of time to think about it and maybe do some reading and put together some good resources.
So I had this idea when we put this together last minute, because I had a cancellation tonight and I wanted to get you on anyway. So I was immediately like, because my schedule is really full last month and this month because of this book here that I've you know, been stuck in for right. about, I mean, it's a close to 700 page book on there's so much whiplash in my reading. I'm like reading about, I'm reading books about eschatology, and then I'm reading books about foreign policy over the last 30 and 40 years over between America and, but really, I read this book touches on the Middle East too, Middle East, Eastern Europe, all that. So it's a little bit crazy. Voluntary liberal. It was a debate on pacifism. So he asked, "What was the debate on pacifism?" It was should Christians or wasn't the resolution? Does the Bible teach pacifism for Christians? I think that was
I think that's right.
Exact, because we wanted to be very specific. Because your view is, if I make sure I steel man this, is that pacifism is, so you would say like libertarianism, like the NAP and all that, is sort of like the natural order, natural law, and that Christians obviously adhere to that, but that we're called to a higher ethic, which would be either pacifism in a, so either a full-blown like purist pacifism, which is a rejection of all force, or you argued for that it, you know, maybe it's a slightly modified pacifism where some force is allowed but not lethal force.
I'd say lethal force at the very least would be disallowed. Right.
Right. So that's what the debate was about. It was pretty productive, although it was kind of like it ended up being half a debate about pacifism and half a debate about the Sermon on the Mount, because we kind of read the Sermon on the Mount a little bit differently, which gets into, I know, like the different, like Reformed, we tend to see mostly continuity between Old and New Covenant, and there's a bit more, you guys, I mean, it's not like full-blown dispensationalism, but there is more in your theological reading, more of a discontinuity there. So that was partly why I think we approached that passage a little bit differently, which played out in the debate.
I think, you know, Anabaptists are a bit like, I mean, those who kind of are familiar with the theology of Paul stuff, like the apocalyptic Paul idea, that something really drastic and dramatic happened through the incarnation that sort of became like this, you know, dividing point of history, that something sort of changed after that. And so there's more discontinuity, you know, between how the Old Covenant and the New Covenant are approached.
Are you reading this?
Am I opposed to lethal force against animals? Interestingly, I'm a vegetarian myself, but I also acknowledge that people, while I don't think that people should mistreat animals or abuse animals, I think it's okay to eat an animal. The distinction I would make, ultimately, what I'm arguing for pacifism, not necessarily from a philosophical, secular philosophical starting point, but from what I think Jesus and Paul and John and Peter have to say about the subject.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was funny he asked that, because I was like, well, he's a vegetarian, so
I mean, I was gonna say the voluntary liberal, I don't know if you saw this, also said happy January 6th. It's January 7th. I can't allow that. It's like you can't be doing playing Christmas music the day before Thanksgiving. If you celebrate, if you observe January 6th, you have to observe it on January 6th.
I mean, maybe it's like maybe liberals and libertarians are like Catholics and Orthodox, where they celebrate Easter on different days. So maybe, maybe liberals celebrate January 6th and January 7th. I mean, you know, so.
It's a lunar versus solar calendar kind of thing. Maybe.
So this idea I had, and we can talk more about the debate after we do this, but I wanted to, you know, I think this is a fun thing to do intellectually when you do debates, is to be able to steel man each other's positions and really kind of push yourself to think about things from both angles. I did speech and debate when I was in high school. And so like you literally, when you do that, including on the collegiate level, you have to be able to debate both sides. Cause like between rounds, they will literally just like flip coins or they'll set it up beforehand and be like, this round you're taking the pro, next you're taking the con, you know, or the affirm and the negative, depending on which style you did. So, what we're going to do here is I'm going to start by presenting what I think was Cody's strongest argument, in the debate. And then Cody's going to do the same in reverse. So, I think you made a lot of good points that I generally agreed on in terms of why I do think that, although I'm not a pacifist, why I think that pacifism is sort of a preference, or like nonviolent solutions should be a preference we had. But one of the points you made, which is something I'd heard before, but it's always a valid point when it comes up, because I had a point about how I'm concerned about not being able to handle certain problems if we take force off the table. And that is a concern I have. But on the flip side, just as when we take state interventions off the table for solving problems, and then the free market is able to innovate solutions we might not have been able to foreseen, because now we have more mental power and spontaneous order, so to speak, being freed up to actually, you know, attack the problem rather than sort of like, you know, central planning and just giving this to the state. People are kind of lazy and don't look into the solutions as much or think about them as much. So there's kind of a similar argument there for pacifism, which is that if you're a pacifist, you are going to and especially this scales up, more people are pacifists, you're going to have an effect where, because of violence, or at least lethal force, is taken off the table, you're going to think about what solutions you can have for certain problems that you might have used to think lethal force was the only option, right? And I think Bob Murphy makes a good point about this too in his arguments about private law and how like a private law society would tend towards pacifism, because like even if like you could say, I think the way he puts it is that force and lethal force might be sometimes like justified responses, but they wouldn't be best practices in a lot of these sort of like private law market governing societies, right? Because it's just bad optics. It wouldn't be good for, you know, shareholders, for maintaining profits and whatnot. It's like, it's always going to be cleaner. It's always going to be a, you know, like if the goal of institutions is to make a profit, to maintain their image, reputation and whatnot, then to the degree they can solve legal disputes and violations of rights without lethal force, the better off they're going to be. So I think there's a lot of persuasive power to that. I think that was the argument I found the most compelling.
And I like the way you framed that there, because I think you've given me another argument. It's like the Hayekian argument for pacifism, right? That like,
right.
that you have to sort of leave the door open for the spontaneous order and nonviolent solutions instead of sort of centralizing those decisions.
Doug asked an interesting question too, which I do think, and I've never pulled the trigger, was the expression I was going to use on this. But I know that they make non-lethal ballistics, right? Whether that's not like, you know, guns that are designed to shoot that, or you can even, I think, buy special rounds for guns you already have, which shoot at least potentially less lethal types of ammunition. So, yeah, I mean, that's stuff that we should always be thinking about. I own firearms, but I'm not, and I said this in the debate, I don't like the part of gun culture in conservative circles or libertarian circles where it's like, and I'm not against open carry, not against concealed carry, because I do that too from time to time, but I don't do it in a sense of like some people do, where like, oh man, I wish a M or F or would, right? Like you could, they're almost like, I'm so excited. It'd be so cool if I got an opportunity to pull my weapon out and use it in self-defense. I'm like, no, that sounds like the worst thing ever. I hope I never, ever, ever have to do. That's like buying a fire extinguisher and being like, man, I really hope my house catches on fire so I can use my fire extinguisher. It's like, are you a sociopath? What's wrong with you?
The rubber bullets thing, I'll have to think about that a little bit, because I'm not a gun guy, but maybe I could start going to the shooting range. And
those can still really hurt, but it's okay. And again, I brought up in the debate.
Yeah, I'm only against lethal force. If I can beat the crap out of a guy, I'm fine with that.
but remember, if the rubber bullet hits him in just the right way,
that's true.
It's like
You can't help that. That's accidental. Yeah. I was gonna real quickly another voluntary liberal comment. He says, how do you resist eating steak, Green Lantern level willpower? And I only bring that up because I pulled my little Green Lantern from behind me. But that's cool. So best argument on your side. So you had mentioned this just a little bit ago. And so didn't have time to go back and like watch the debate, but I was thinking about kind of the, what's, you know, sort of stuck with me and kind of at the time what I, where I felt like your kind of strongest arguments were. And ultimately it's kind of the flip side of what you said, right? Which is that, you know, really, you know, the best argument against my side is the practical argument that sometimes lethal force might be necessary to save an innocent life. Although, you know, what is an innocent life really, if Reformed theology is correct? But, and my response to that was that as Christians, our primary duty is to follow and obey Jesus, right? But I think that's a strong rejoinder. You know, Christians should obey Jesus. But I think you and I maybe approach some of these ethical questions differently because you do see more continuity. But when I think about like what Paul has to say about the law and ethics, he seems to be really focused on love, even if it means setting aside some of the like Mosaic laws. And so, you know, thinking about kind of going down that path a little bit, the question I sort of ask myself is, are there exceptions to following Jesus's commands as well, where love would mean setting aside an explicit commandment from Jesus? And I'm inclined to say no, but I think that we could have a really interesting discussion about that. I don't think that you would quite make that argument. I think you would say that Jesus's turn the other cheek command is more like an example of enemy love than something that Jesus intends for us to follow to the letter all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, and this gets into our different readings of the Sermon on the Mount, but like, I think what Jesus was saying there by turning the other cheek was not a call to universal non-violence and non-retaliation, but rather to say what he was, like, the context of what he was correcting was people using what was supposed to be a legal principle of, you know, sort of like proportionality in just retribution, and then using that at like using a legal principle as a sort of mentality with how they live their life, right? Like it, like where you just, you know, oh, this person was crappy to me, I'm gonna be crappy to them. Like, I mean, a good example is like if you're in a workplace environment and you have a really crappy coworker and they treat you like crap and they leave stuff laying around and you have to clean up after them, and you know, maybe they don't like, they mess up your workspace or something, and then you're just like, okay, well, if they're going to be that way to me, I'm going to be that way to them, right? And there's countless examples. People do this in workplaces and families, unfortunately, sometimes in churches. And I think what the purpose there was to be like, don't confuse what is supposed to be just like a limit on sort of like not having excesses in the pursuit of justice with like a, here's how you should live your life. Like, rather, like, you should primarily be more concerned with if people have done wrong to you, you should try to just bear that and send and instead respond in kindness and in love. And this is even just an Old Testament. Like, this is talked about in, I think, in Proverbs. I think there might be one other passage, but it's like where it compares to, like, if you do kindness to your enemy, it's like dumping... cold, or maybe that's the New Testament one, I forget. But anyway,
it's in Proverbs, but Paul quotes it in Romans 12.
That's right. So the point being there that, like, you know, that is a point of continuity. Like, enemy love does exist in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Now, I would even grant that, like, listen, I think something is significant in the life and death of Jesus, and that the new covenant brings something new. So I think, like, you know, what the author of Hebrews talks about, like what we saw in types and shadows, what was only partly revealed in the Old Covenant is now fully revealed and realized in the person of Jesus Christ and in his teachings, his life, his example. So, you know, it's like, but it's not like, it's not like it was never seen before and then suddenly Jesus was like, oh, here's this brand new thing that contradicts this old thing, right? Like, I'm not even saying that's what you're saying, but that's... Mm-hmm. That's what I think some people who make the pacifistic interpretation there are saying. And I'm just like, well, for me, that line alone is not enough to make me a pacifist, but it certainly is enough for me to say, now where this extends to is that, yeah, even in the realm of justice and of self-defense, even like, I think if you're automatically in a mindset where you're like, you expect to use lethal force even when it is legally justified, like you should be open to being guided by the Holy Spirit or circumstances to be like I've thought of, so like I teach or no, I don't teach, I preach responsible gun ownership. Mm-hmm. And I know some people think that this is like, it sounds good on paper, it wouldn't work good in reality. But I think there are ways to have a firearm on you and to use it not to shoot people, but rather to use it as a means of de-escalating a conflict when someone is trying to initiate violence, right? So, like, now maybe someone could say, oh, that situation, you shouldn't do that. You could just pull it out and shoot them. And maybe in a libertarian sense, that's correct. But as a Christian, I'd say, well, maybe you'd be legally justified in doing it. But as a Christian, I think that using best judgment, discernment, guidance of the Holy Spirit, if there's a way you can use the threat of violence to, but not actually pull the trigger, that should be something you should be open to doing.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, so there's a lot you said there. So I might go back just a little bit.
Yeah. Sorry. So,
I think on the kind of continuity, discontinuity thing, what I see is a lot of Christian pacifists who are kind of more on the progressive side, and they see a tension between the Old and New Testaments, and they don't really know what to do with it. So they kind of throw out the Old Testament. They see it as uninspired or less inspired or whatever. And I think what you see, I think, from the opposite end of the spectrum, I don't want to say the pro-violence, but something like that, is I think that they tend to want to see continuity, and they sort of see so much continuity that they kind of, I think, let the Old Testament win out, because they say, well, there can't be a contradiction.
Yeah.
And so if there's not a contradiction here, if there's no change, and the Old Testament allowed for certain forms of violence, then that must mean the New Testament allows for certain forms of violence, right? So they want to see that sort of happening all the way through. What I think the Anabaptists did correctly, and early Anabaptists, what I think I'm trying to do is say, well, there is tension, but I'm not going to throw out the Old Testament. Like, the Old Testament is inspired, but there's nevertheless a change, and one of those changes does have to do with violence. And I think we talked about this. Like, I mean, I think the Old Testament does not really support what people who are trying to argue for violence want it to. So you don't really have self-defense as a major theme, an ethical theme, especially in the Old Testament. You have, what today we would call genocide. You know, we have the sort of the holy wars, the ban. And even in some of these passages, like the one about the intruder, I think it's important to note that there's a different, it's treated differently if you kill an intruder at night versus in the daytime. And the implication is that if you kill an intruder at night, it's an accident. If you kill an intruder in the daytime, you did it on purpose. And so there's a penalty for killing an intruder in the daytime, but not for killing at night.
I always thought the reason for that was that if you kill it at nighttime, it's because you're not in a position to really make it. Like, if someone's breaking into your house at night, the assumption is, like, they mean you harm. Whereas, you know, if someone's intruding your house,
if someone breaks into your house at any time, they mean you harm, I think, right?
I mean, I guess you could say that, but, like, in the daytime, you might be able to make an argument that, like, first of all, I mean, I don't think most people make robberies or attempts to harm you in the middle of the day. So, like, maybe they're there by mistake, or maybe they are there to steal stuff, but maybe they wouldn't. I don't know. I mean, I've heard different things on this.
Right.
Well, certainly.
Yeah, the text doesn't say exactly why. So we sort of fill in what we want that meaning to be. But I think that the most obvious meaning to me is someone is trying to steal something from you or break into your house. They mean you harm, or at least to take your things. But it's treated differently in the day and the night. Why is that? It seems to me it's treated differently in the night because you wake up, you don't know what's going on, you can't see. It's the 13th century BC. So, you know, your lights aren't working. Your lamp's not, you can't turn your lamp on. Whereas in the daytime, I think you have more control over your actions. That's, I think, the best reading of it. But once again, it doesn't really say. So we kind of fill in that meaning ourselves about what the significance of it is.
Well, to be clear, there has to be something that's different, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think where we would agree is that there's something there that we have to wrestle with and come away with saying, you know what, like, there are limits for God's people, even in the Old Covenant, in terms of, there are times where maybe legally, under natural law, you'd be justified to act in self-defense. Mm-hmm. But for God's people, he does call us, even in the Old Covenant, to higher standards, that there can be circumstances where we are called to, you know what, like, we need to at least exercise some level of restraint, right? Because, I mean, there's all sorts of counterfactuals. Like, what if they break into your home and then they're holding a knife to you, right? Like, there's things that aren't brought up in that text exactly. But I think the point there is to just demonstrate that, like, If you are in the best position possible to know what's going on and to act upon it, that like you shouldn't act out of bloodlust or like just out of like, well, I'm allowed. And this is like, I think we would agree so much what the Sermon on the Mount is like correcting this attitude of like, you know, looking at the law as a means of like, well, how, like, what's the maximum limit of evil that I can live down to?
Or another way to think about it is, what are my rights? And that's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. And I think as libertarians, we should care about our rights and the rights of others. But as Christians, we should be willing to let our rights be, you know, intruded upon a little bit. And we should sort of take that with a certain amount of grace and love. And
I think
part of what I see in the sermon, if it were by itself, maybe there's room to wiggle out of some of this stuff. But I think Jesus lives out that turn the other cheek command. And then you get to Peter, and Peter says to the person who, the slave who's being beaten or the person who's being oppressed against by the state, he says, do what Jesus did. Jesus didn't threaten. Jesus didn't fight back. And so I think there's this kind of little, you know, through line through the New Testament where you have Jesus giving the ethical command, then he gives the example, and then Jesus said, and then Peter says, look at the example. That's how you're supposed to be. So I think, you know, we could debate about whether or not there's a little bit of wiggle room there, or whether that's kind of a principle that's more general that there could be some exceptions to. My tendency is to, I think, you know, read it, I think, kind of on the surface and say, you know, this is what Jesus seems to be telling us to do. So I think that should be the guideline, right? At least.
I mean, like, I see your point. I still think that it's hard for me to take a hard principle like non-lethal force is explicitly being taught against without that being made rather explicit. And so, yeah, did Jesus live out basically a pacifist ethic? I mean, yeah, there's really no instance of, unless you think that tables and chairs have rights, there's no instance of Jesus violating anyone's rights or, you know, initiating violence against anyone. You know, yeah, I mean, people like to point out the whips and the flipping of tables, but it's like, I mean, yeah, sure, it was scary, I guess, but I mean, I mean, there's a stronger argument to be made there. Not a strong argument, just a stronger argument to be made there that Jesus is a communist because he doesn't respect private property than there is to say although it's really his property because it's the temple. So, I mean, he's protecting his property, but I'm just saying,
but we're not Marianne Williamson. We don't think that tables and chairs have rights.
Exactly. So we can leave that to the side. I would agree with you that, Jesus lived that out. I just wonder like, okay, does he live that out as a pattern that has a lot of wisdom for us, or is he living it out? And that's like a, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth because I know you're not trying to say it's legalistic, but like, is that the exact calling we're supposed to live to, that like, it's not just a preference, it's a, you have to avoid this. And if you don't, maybe there's grace for you, but that's still a sin. And I would say, I don't think that it's automatically a sin to use even lethal force in certain circumstances. Because live by the sword, die by the sword. It's like, I think it's a lot to go from that. Like the context there is like, Jesus has to be turned over. And I know you said that there was like three observations to that you had, and that like three reasons why Jesus rebukes him. One is because of the using of the sword. The other, because he's not acting out in faith. I forget the third one.
Yeah, as far as the three different ways that it's understood, or because some people say it's because Jesus says, I could call the angels to defend me if I wanted to. And so basically Jesus says, under normal circumstances, this would be okay. But in this one circumstance, it's not the right thing to do because I have a mission and it involves me dying. And so that's how it's often interpreted, is that's really the only concern that Jesus has.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, like, I think it is sort of like, in that specific moment, it's not, I don't see Jesus rebuking people acting with force in the defense of others. I see him rebuking Peter not trusting in Jesus, saying, like, you, like, because it's not like it's blind, like, this was going to happen. He's told them it's going to happen. And Peter, It's like, at this point, Peter has already said, you're the Messiah, right? So it's like, Jesus, like, how are you going to say I'm the Messiah and then think that, like, this is outside my control and that you need to take matters into your own hands? Like, that's what I think is the clear thing Jesus is rebuking. I think you can try to say maybe there's a secondary lesson about the use of force, but I don't know that you can, like, just derive a clear, explicit teaching that, like, oh, and because of this, we know that force and lethal force are off the table for Christians.
Well, but I think that the thing is, you say there might be a second thing. The first thing that Jesus said is, put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Then he goes on to say, how else could I accomplish this task? So both are given as rationales for why Peter should put the sword back in its place.
What does he mean by live by the sword, die? Like, because I take that to just mean, like, not you're using self-defense. It's that if you put your faith in, like, in that instance, the sword is sort of, like, representative of, like, you seeking to live your life by your own means and not by faith, by works and not by faith.
Well, I mean, it's not just, I mean, the sword doesn't just mean trusting in yourself and not in God. I mean, the sword is an instrument of violence that you use to kill people. So, I mean, I think that's at least, has to be at least part of the message that's there. But I mean, you could talk about, you know, Paul talks about carnal weapons versus spiritual weapons. You can make that distinction, that the person who lives by the sword is living carnally, and he's not living spiritually, and he's going to die as a result of that. So I think you can make that connection, but that also sort of implies not just what you're saying, but also what I'm saying. The point about, I think, whether or not Jesus is an example we should be following. I mean, Peter says, to this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. And so, I mean, to me, I mean, Peter seems to think that nonviolence is a calling for Christians, that when we were called by God, that was part of that calling. And that Christ would be an example that we would follow in his nonviolence. So to me, I think it's,
well, we should lay our lives down for others. You mentioned what it says in John 15, you know, it's like, no greater love is there than this, than, you know, a man, you know, put down his life for his friends, and he calls us his friends, and he's called us. Yeah. But I don't
which doesn't mean carpet bomb Baghdad, as so many people interpret it to mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously we're in agreement there, right? I'm not advocating for initiating. Yeah, you can't love someone by initiating violence against them. I just don't know that you can. I think you can fail to love. Like, I don't know that I'd be loving my wife or my children if I said I won't use lethal force to protect you if it came down to it, right? I mean, there's a passage like, if those who doesn't provide for your family is worse than the non-believer, it's like, when I should provide for my family, I have to use, it's like, it's not that I don't see the tension there. Mm-hmm. I see tension there. That's kind of my whole point, is that, like, there's not a clear teaching. There's a tension. I think we have to, and I think my entire thesis was, the Bible doesn't teach pacifism because the Bible doesn't teach an ism. The Bible teaches what the Bible teaches, and a lot of these things are held in tension, and we have to just live in that tension and, you know, sort of, you know, do it. There are some things that are made clear, and where things aren't made clear, some of it's personal conscience, right? If you're convicted to not use force at all, let alone lethal force, then you should probably follow that conviction. But I don't know that it should be immediately clear that, like, every Christian is going to read the text and walk away with that, with reading that tension and walk away with that black and white conviction, so to speak.
Well, I mean, perhaps not. I mean, I think that there is something going on that's a bit carnal, though. So, like, when you talk about attention, so, like, before you start talking about tension, we talked about what the text was saying, and then you sort of said, like, I don't feel like I could sort of be willing to take violence off the table for someone that I care about. Now, that's not something you're reading out of scripture. That's something that you're feeling personally, and I get it.
I was taken out of scripture. It was, the man who doesn't,
the person,
you know, care for his, provide for his family. It's like, well, part of provision would be security, right? So if I don't do that which is required to protect my family, and if part of what's required is lethal force, then I'm kind of failing my obligation to my family. And I think we also have similar obligations to our neighbors as well.
Well, so, so, that, also, what, sorry, just real quick, would it have been a bad example? Sorry, what I'm trying to say. So taking care of your family, providing for your family. So do you think that Paul would have suggested that it would be wrong then to exist publicly as a Christian in a culture that is opposed to Christianity because you put your family in danger by doing so?
I see your point there. I mean, you know, so we obviously cannot forsake Christ to protect our family, right? You know, and I've always made a distinction between which I know. So this is why, actually, I remember an old debate I did on pacifism years ago. What they said I was saying was that and I actually kind of think there's some merit to this. I tend to be pacifistic in the space of where we're being persecuted for our faith. Mm-hmm. Because I actually think that the Old Testament and New Testament example is that when you're being persecuted for your faith, nonviolent resistance is the model of everyone, including Jesus. But there's also times where there are just people who are committing violence and, you know, David picks up a stone and throws it at Goliath and cuts his head off, right? And that was a man after God's own heart. I don't know that I don't see anywhere where now David does a lot of other things wrong, but I don't see where he's ever condemned for, you know, using lethal force against Goliath, which and I don't see the Sermon on the Mount as enough to say, oh, what Jesus is saying there, that this was okay and now it's not. Like, I don't think
in the text. Yeah, there's nothing also that says that Joshua was wrong for putting a sword in an infant. In an Amalekite infant, right?
Well, yeah, that I mean, we'd have to take a shot for me bringing up covenant theology, because that's the response to that.
You got to understand covenant theology. Yeah, so there's but I think what we're getting at here is there's obviously, you know, some tensions, and it's I agree that these aren't necessarily easy things to resolve. I think though the thing that I think is toughest for my side to resolve is not the biblical data, because I think my side can handle the biblical data pretty darn well. The difficulty I think is in that application. That once I've decided that the Bible says this and this is what it means to obey Christ, what if I'm in a situation where I feel or think that violence is the only way to protect someone who's innocent or someone that I care about? What do I do then? And that I think gets really difficult. And it does, you know, hit me as somebody who has children and a wife and cares about them and wants to do everything I can for them. And you know, who maybe goes out of his way at times to, you know, give my wife and kids things that maybe I shouldn't. And, you know, I think, there's some tension to work out there on my side, but I don't really think it's in the biblical data. It's more just in how do we apply this and also maintain
think there is some in the biblical data, but I think it's also in the application of the biblical data. Because you have some data, like, and this is with a lot of things, not just pacifism. We see this in soteriology. We see this in eschatology, right? There are passages that premillennialists have. There are passages that postmillennialists have. There are passages that Calvinists have. There are passages that Arminians have, right? And there's passages that you and I can point to on either side. Like, you could bring up Jesus says that if you don't love me and hate your, you know, whoever doesn't hate their father or their mother or their brother to follow me, will not, I forget what he says, but like, you know, will not enter the kingdom of heaven or something like that. And so, yeah, like, you should put Christ before everything, including your family, which is what Abraham did, right? But also God intervened and said, don't kill your son. And so, because we also have biblical data that says to provide for your family, right? So I think there, like, if I was being persecuted for my faith, if like they showed up the door and said, renounce Christ or we're going to burn your house down, I'm not going to renounce Christ. But if someone breaks into my house in the middle of the night and I enter my kid's room and there, you know, someone's about to do violence on my children, I'm going to use lethal force at that point.
Well, let's say we make the comparison more exact. I mean, what if they say renounce Christ or I hurt your child?
Yeah. I mean, at that point I would not renounce. I mean, you could, so someone could make an argument that you could just lie and that Christ would not be upset with you for that. You could make a persuasive argument there. But I guess, you know, even in that there's tension, right? But I will say at least the biblical, in that case, the biblical data, so I don't know if there's ever a time where anyone in the Bible said, if you don't renounce God, we'll hurt your children. There's the opposite of that. There's the Egyptians. If you don't let my people go and don't put blood in the door, well, God, the Spirit of the Lord will come down and take your children. But but nothing on the other side. If it's just my life on the line, though, there's a lot of biblical data that says that I need to not forsake Christ.
Well, and I'm not trying to do to you what people do to me, where they back you into a corner and make you answer uncomfortable questions. But
no, I think these are hard questions. I think we both acknowledge these are hard questions, and I don't think so. Listen, if these were hard questions and the biblical data was just undeniable, like I'm not saying you don't have a case at all. I just don't think it's just to me it doesn't meet a certain threshold. like for me to really say like the Bible is teaching that the use of lethal force is forbidden, and that's a lower threshold than what other pacifists do, which is to say no force at all. I just think that like anytime someone says the Bible teaches this hard line, like black and white thing, I'm going to apply a pretty high threshold to that. Now I think what I say, which I think resolves the tension better, is that the Bible teaches that nonviolent resistance and nonviolent, or at least the least violent options available, are the preference that we should strive for. Well, I don't think there's any way to get around that. Like the biblical data would makes it absolutely clear that we have to detest violence. Also, another great argument you made, which I 100% agree with, is that if you use lethal force, that should not be viewed as a good thing, which might seem like I'm contradicting myself, but I'm not. Like, I think that's a tragedy. I think this might be a good thing to end on. I think part of maybe where we see things differently here, and this is, again, that tension that Christianity and libertarianism have, where I kind of, like, we live in a fallen world. And I think that there are going to be a lot of situations where people of faith are going to struggle to know how to live biblical principles out, just as libertarians, like, you know, like, listen, you look at libertarian legal theory and libertarian ethics in a vacuum, they're really simple. But then we live in a very statist world, and then you're like trying to figure out how to operate and how to act, how to respond to certain things. And it can be very nuanced and difficult. And I guess all that to say that there are sometimes going to be no-win situations, right? Where, like, there is not going to be a, other than an intervention of God, like a miracle, there can be situations where there's no good outcome. Like, and I will say, like, in the situation where someone is threatening to kill or essay my child, and I have the means to use lethal force to stop them and save my child, neither outcome is good there, right? So at that point, it's just like, what's the least bad outcome? And I don't think that there's a Christian principle that says, well, at that point, you have two bad outcomes. I'm going to pick the outcome where I'm more concerned with the life of my child and the fact that he's innocent, then even though I might have, as a Christian, concern for the person who's committing the violence, and like, I don't want to kill them. I know that they're an image bearer of God as well. I need to pray for their salvation. I need to hope that I don't kill them, that they can be revived somehow from the lethal force that I've inflicted upon them, but that their rights are not as important right now, this moment, as my child's rights or my neighbor's rights or etc. That's kind of where it comes down to for me. It's like, I feel like sometimes certain pacifistic arguments can seem to say like, well, we can't acknowledge that there are just, you know, bad outcome. It's like, so I don't know what your response to that would be, but that's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah. I mean, so I'll say two things. One thing is that, like, I just kind of want to put a fine point on something we had been talking about, which is, you know, when you talk about providing, You know, there are limits, it sounds like, to what both of us will do to save a life, right? There are certain things that we, certain places where we draw the line. So the question, so it's not like, you know, you're an absolutist in one regard and I'm an absolutist in the other direction. You know, we both right. agree on that point. The other yeah. thing I think we both agree on, at least, and I think we end up in a sort of a similar place, is that neither option in a somebody dies scenario is a good option. It's one that we should desire or hope for.
Absolutely.
But, yep. but so that being said, if there's something that we might want to say is bad, or maybe even use the big S word and say that, you know, either option is sinful in some regard. I mean, Bonhoeffer seemed to suggest that there might be a situation where you either do nothing, and so you are, you know, you're committing a sin of omission, or you do something that maybe is bad, but it protects the future in some way, and that's a sin of commission, right? But ultimately, what Bonhoeffer's answer to that is, well, whichever way you go, there's grace, right? So when you're stuck between two bad decisions and you're not really sure what to do, you do your best to follow God and to follow the Spirit as you think you're being led. But whichever choice that you make there, however you act, there is grace for whatever you did with a guilty conscience or an unclear conscience.
Yeah.
And so maybe you or I both in that same situation end up trying to take out the person who's wanting to harm someone that we care about. But we both also appeal to God's grace in that scenario. So I think, you know, I think there's just, it's really just kind of where we want to put the emphasis. Like a lot of ways that we disagree with each other, it's where we put the emphasis, because I think we both end up in a lot of the same places.
So I basically agree with all of that. And I think my hesitancy with the pacifist camp is that they tend to not only not be anywhere close to where you're at in terms of like having that grace and even allowing the use of force, even, you know, and just barring lethal force. But is it in terms of like the lack of acknowledging that there can be situations where, yeah, like doing nothing results in bad thing and sin, and maybe even acting results in some sin. I mean, listen, even the things that we do good, like if we understand the inner workings of our own hearts and minds and whatnot, like a lot of the things that we do that are good are even like, you know, soiled with some selfish intention, right? And some sin mixed in. And it's hard to, this way, you know, no one is righteous, not one, right? We all rely on the grace of God for everything we do. And I think there's two things here. One, prevention is always, always, always better than cure, right? And I think that's why I care so much about libertarianism, because to me, libertarianism is one of the most useful tools we have outside of scripture for creating a more peaceful world where we are pursuing things that are Christian values, which is, you know, less violence and a preference for conflict resolution that takes force off the table or at least minimizes it. If pacifism was redefined as basically just that, which is my second point, which is rather than a teaching of a hard rule, but again, just this idea that like our goal should be to strive towards solutions and responses of conflict resolution that are either that don't require force, or that opt for non-lethal force as much as our creative energies and output can generate, then I would basically say, like, if that's what pacifism was, then that's basically where I'm at. Like, that's the space I essentially occupy. What I push back against is more the hard insistence of that, like, well, actually what Jesus and the Bible and the New Testament explicitly teach is this sort of like hard, fast rule rather than sort of like a preference and a pattern, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, when you said you prefer prevention to kind of the back end here, I thought you were going to say put an NRA sticker on your front door, but don't necessarily buy the gun.
No, I mean, if you're going to go that way, you could, what you'd want to do is, God, there's so many different jokes you could make. You could, I could just get, if I wanted to make sure no one broke into my house or came after me, I mean, I could just put up a bunch of I'll buy a bunch of Reformed Libertarians merchandise and a bunch of Reformed theology stuff, and you know, have like I'll have a sign up front that says like I love Dooiweerd out front, like I love the yep. Belgic Confession out front, and people just be like, I don't understand what's going on here. I want nothing to do with it. I'm going to stay as far away from that house as possible because they seem crazy.
Right. And I was going to say you put a libertarian, one of those libertarian yard signs, not a Chase Oliver, maybe a Michael Rechtenwald, you know, something sort of a sign that looks anti-Semitic or something like that, I think would probably keep people out.
Oh gosh. Yeah, no, there's so many jokes we could make, and I don't want to make some of the jokes I want to make on air.
I know. Listen, I had a whole list of Angela McCardle and Chase Oliver jokes that I was going to use if the occasion called for it, and it just didn't quite work out. So,
oh boy, you wouldn't be the first one to. I think people. You know what's funny? Like people, I think they get a certain opinion of me online, and listen, I have my opinions, but I let people on all the time who have harsh disagreements with me. Even like, I mean, I'm friends with Angela. I've had people on my show that, you know, think she's an awful person who, you know, make all sorts of statements about her and whatnot that like, I don't agree with. I don't even always appreciate when they make those comments, but it's like, I'm just always willing to have the conversation, I suppose. And to like, I care more about with pretty much everyone finding, I mean, I love the compare and contrast. I want to figure out where we agree. I want to figure out where we disagree. And I just feel like there's too many people in the liberty movement right now who just don't want to do that. And I don't really know the solution to it. I've kind of like, I don't know. I'm happy LCI is doing good because I'm kind of at the point now where I'm just so burnt out of the libertarian movement that like I kind of want to focus more on the Christian side of things more than the at least the LP side stuff. It's like, cause on one hand, I do believe that there's a role where you can make some things better in politics, but on the other hand, I do kind of, you know, like, maybe it's my inner Anabaptist in me, but sometimes I feel like, man, like at what cost though? Because at the end of the day, I mean, not even like a legalistic thing, but just you're robbed of so much joy, so much time, so much energy, so much resources. And there's an opportunity cost there, right? Like, would that time and energy be spent better, spent somewhere else? Anyway, maybe that can be a conversation for another day though, because we're already at an hour and a half. do you have any closing thoughts on anything we've talked about before we head out?
Well, that was a good ending. I always say in Winograd Veritas. I think we've talked a little bit about the debate, kind of reflections on that. We talked about Anabaptism, which I thought was an interesting discussion. We did cover that I'm going to be taking over some of the co-hosting duties of the Libertarian Christian podcast moving forward. And we mentioned that LCI is publishing, well, we didn't mention other books, but LCI is publishing at least 3 books this year. But the first one is coming out in February, and it's mine, and it's called The Anarchist Anabaptist. And we hope that folks will get it and enjoy it. And even if you aren't Anabaptist or Anabaptist inclined, I think you'll find the arguments really interesting and challenging. And I hope that you'll engage with me in the future on it.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to. You've actually sent me a copy, which I'll be reading here soon, and probably getting you on in February to talk to you more about the actual contents of it. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm excited. We have 3 books. We have yours. We have one on. We have a book on COVID-19 and the lockdowns coming out, and then we're working on a second edition of Faith Seeking Freedom. So really excited about all that, doubling down on stuff like this, green room shows, conversations, interviews, all that good stuff.
And I was an early reader on the COVID book, and it's good. So I recommend people get that too when it comes out.
I don't know if Doug sent me a copy yet, but I'm excited to,
to
dive into that as well. Yeah, there's just so much. I mean, the church was really divided on that too. I hate, I hate division, man. I mean, like, and sometimes I feed into it too much, but
yeah,
I just, I don't know. I'm hoping, like, maybe we could probably agree on this. Like, I like, as much as like you and I will go back and forth, and sometimes the rest of us go about it back and forth in our signal chats and whatnot, we have a real pretty diverse set of backgrounds and opinions here at LCI. And even when we fight and bicker, we come back and we're on the same page. We're on the same team. We have the same goals. And I'm hoping that LCI can maybe lead by example in this regard, maybe where we can, like, I think I've said this a lot. I think the church and the Liberty movement have a culture problem. Right. And I think, hopefully we can maybe be a good positive example in terms of like how to foster a better culture in these spaces, be more ecumenical, be more, Christ-like. So, I'm optimistic on that front. And I'm really like we spent the last hour and 30 minutes, you know, talking about our different opinions on how we view certain things that are very, you know, very important topics. But it's like at the end of the day, there's also way more we agree on than we disagree on. And we're excited to explore these areas because it's to the edification of us all. I think, I mean, we're all what unites us, that we're committed to following Christ to the best of our ability and understanding that, you know, following Christ and, promoting liberty in the world is what's going to promote the most amount of human flourishing and peace in the world. And that's what we're like, that's what motivates me. I think you probably know that by now. Like, my biggest thing is war, because at the end of the day, what I detest the most is violence. I detest when anyone is hurting anywhere, when violence is being initiated anywhere. And I just, I want the church, I want libertarians, I want us to be an effective, I want both of those groups to be effective at standing up for the least of these in the world, right? So I'm excited for the ways that we can be doing that. I'm really glad that you're part of the team and helping Doug over there on the Libertarian Christians podcast. Doug's a slacker. He needs a little, yeah, little extra push.
He needs the whip. Yeah. No, and this has been a really wonderful team to be a part of. And, I think I'm reminded of the episode of The Office where Michael Scott is talking about Andy Bernard, and he says, talking about how he actually is a good salesman. And he says, "You sold us on Andy, a product that nobody wanted." And I feel like that's me here at LCI. And so somehow I've been welcomed and appreciated, and it's really been really pleased to be here. I was going to say, someone mentioned in the comments, just want to mention this real quick, got any mutualist left libertarians at LCI? Kind of depends on how you might define that. I have some sensitivities in that regard. And one thing that I'd like to do with the Libertarian Christian podcast is include some of those voices in the picture as well. In fact, I've been trying to get certain people, maybe I won't name drop anybody right now, but certain people on and who to maybe express some of those perspectives. Because I think what I'd really like to do with a Libertarian Christian podcast is explore the ways that libertarianism is really for everybody. And how the philosophy is a solid, strong philosophy that's really the way that we live our lives in every other way except for when it comes to politics. And so I want to talk to, you know, people of color. I want to talk to women. I want to talk to people who are on the left and sort of get their perspective on why libertarianism is not just for, white guys who like anime, although we're happy to have you too, and you need to be here, but everybody, right?
So, yeah. No, 100% agree with that. Like when I did my episode one of Biblical Anarchy, I spent a lot of time talking about even like the first anarchists, like Proudhon, and like there is valuable lessons to learn from mutualists and left anarchists. Even though I think they get some things wrong, they also got some things right. So I don't think we have any. It depends how you define those things. Like, I mean, sure. Mutualist is easier to define. Left libertarian is like, that means like 20 different things to 10 different people. So yeah. That's the joke. You have two libertarians in a room, you'll have 10 different opinions. So
there you go.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being here, Cody. Hopefully this is the first of many conversations to come. Thank you everyone in the audience for listening. Make sure before you hop off that wherever you're watching, give this video a thumbs up, subscribe if you haven't already, as the bottom ticker there shows, if you believe in what we're doing here at Libertarian Christian Institute. You know, trying to foster a culture that is Christ-like, that believes in liberty, that's ecumenical, that is trying to bring the message of hope in the gospel and liberty in Christ and, you know, freedom from the state, because we understand that Christ is King. That's what we're about. And if you want to support us in our mission, you know, even though our fundraiser went well at the end of last year, money doesn't grow on tree or in money printers, unfortunately. That's not real money anyway. And we don't have access to those money printers. So we always need all the support that we can get so we can continue to keep on growing and going out there and doing what we do. So thank you, everybody, for that. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I don't think I have any more shows scheduled the rest of this week. Oh, Cody, I don't think it's your first one, but you just had last week one of your first episodes of the Libertarian Christian podcast come out. So everyone go check that out if you haven't already. That's actually on my playlist for tomorrow. So I talk about it, but I haven't listened to it yet, but we're getting there.
Let me know what you think when you hear it.
I will. All right, everyone. That's all we have for you guys tonight. Talk to you again real soon.